In this month's edition of Midday on Film, an appreciation of actor Marlon Brando on what would have been his 91st birthday. One of America's greatest film stars, Brando's career spanned 5 decades and such roles as the volatile Stanley Kowalski in A Streetcar Named Desire.
Hey, Stella!
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears!
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender.
Luck be a lady tonight.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
You're an errand boy sent by grocery clerks.
Known for his visceral and brooding performances, as well as his off-screen civil rights activism, Marlon Brando left behind an indelible mark on American movie history. An appreciation of Marlon Brando with Midday film critics Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibero after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Marlon Brando, born in Nebraska. I had no idea he was born in Nebraska. His date of birth is April 3rd, 1924. He began his acting career on stage, a student of the method acting technique, which we'll talk about in this hour of Midday on Film. He originated the role of the crude and brutish Stanley Kowalski in 1947 in Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire. In 1951, he received his first Academy Award nomination for his portrayal of Stanley Kowalski in that film. Today, on what would have been his 91st birthday, we take a look at the legendary career of one of the greatest stars of the silver screen. Marlon Brando brought a brooding realism to his more than 40 film credits, roles such as the tortured ex-boxer Terry Malloy in On the Waterfront and the insane Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. Aside from his on-screen appearances, Marlon Brando was also known for his activism. In 1973, Brando boycotted the Academy Awards ceremony, although he won for his portrayal of the all-powerful Don Vito Corleone in Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather. Marlon Brando refused to accept the award due, he said, to the film industry's treatment of Native Americans. He died in July 2004. In this hour of Midday on Film, a look at the remarkable life and career of Marlon Brando. We're joined, of course, by Midday film critics Linda DeLibero, director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, chair and professor in the Department of Film and Video at Stevenson University. Nice to see you both, Chris and Linda. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here, Dan.
Yeah, Marlon thanks. Brando, so much to talk about. This really is a giant. And, you know, you heard me say method acting. I don't want to assume that we know what that is, but it is associated with Marlon Brando, and I think we ought to take a minute here to talk about exactly what that is, what was different about Marlon Brando, and what is method acting? Linda.
Well, he didn't really want to be called a method actor because it was associated so heavily with Lee Strasberg, whom he disliked very much. He was the pupil of Stella Adler, who was an advocate of Stanislavski, the great Russian method proponent and director, actor, theoretician of acting and drama. And basically, this was a movement that had its roots in the late 19th century and came over here because of a number of Americans who became very interested in Stanislavski's methods, which is where the method nomer comes from. And it is basically an approach to acting that asks the actor to really live the character. Sense memory is very important. Objects and a lot of research, living and breathing the part. I think that's kind of the cliche that we have about method acting. And in some ways, unfortunately, that kind of cliche has meant that people misunderstand that it's all about, you know, thinking about when your dog died. Adler was very much opposed to that kind of thing. It's actually a very rigorous approach to acting, but it's very naturalistic as opposed to the theatricality that was the mainstream approach to acting in Hollywood and, of course, on the stage.
Right, right. I saw Laurence Olivier's Henry V, a film version of that, which is basically a film version of the stage version. And even though Laurence Olivier is considered this great actor, I thought it was very much, well, obviously very old school, right? Mm. Was not that, right? Mm-hmm. And right. Then you see the Kenneth Branagh, Henry V, and then you understand the difference. But Marlon Brando, so Marlon Brando in the 1950s, or actually earlier, 1940s, really establish himself as this kind of actor, very different from what people were used to seeing, right?
That's right. He came to embody this new style of acting because of his incredible success first on Broadway in 1947 in, as you said, Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire. If I could just add one more note to this idea of what is method acting. In its most simplest form, it's a focus on internalization of character rather than first and foremost focusing on externalization of behavior. Not that that isn't important, but that is the primary focus. And as Linda said, it has its roots in Konstantin Stanislavski, who had worked with Chekhov in the late 19th century to kind of change the nature of theatrical performance. And then he was still alive in the 30s when Strasberg, Adler, Sandy Meisner went to Russia mm-hmm. and the Soviet Union to work with him. So Brando came to embody this new movement. And without Brando, there would be no Pacino, Robert De Niro, and then the actors of today, you know, Ed Norton, et cetera, these amazing, amazing actors. So we owe him so much because of his wild success promoting this new style of acting.
Born April 3rd, 1924, in Nebraska. So can either of you explain the Nebraska thing with Marlon Brando? Because I'm a little surprised. I guess I didn't know my Brando very well. I assumed he was from New York City, the Bronx, I don't know, Philadelphia, Jersey, someplace like that, you know.
No, he was a Midwestern boy.
Oh, my
like
goodness.
James Dean.
Yeah.
But not the
like
Fondas.
But not like
the Fondas, yes.
I guess because of his roles, I don't think of him that
sure.
way. I think of him as the godfather, you know, out on Long Island somewhere. But
yeah.
Anyway.
He grew up, and he was born in Omaha. They lived there for a while. His parents separated briefly, and then they moved to Libertyville, Illinois, which was basically a farm town. So it was a kind of rural existence outside of Chicago. And his mother was an actress and thought to be kind of an eccentric. She was a drama teacher. Actually, when they were in Omaha, Henry Fonda was one of her, not exactly a pupil, but she promoted him. She put him in the plays at the Playhouse where she worked. And so there was this little Midwestern coterie of acting and drama. And this was the world that he grew up around. And his mother really was the one who encouraged him to act, to emote. She was a very special person. Both of his parents were alcoholics, so he had a pretty turbulent childhood. But his mother was a very fragile and sensitive creature from whom he learned his love of art and drama.
Can you, before we get to the films of Marlon Brando, can you tell us a little bit more about the trajectory of his career, how he got from the Midwest to the stage in, you know, 1947 and A Streetcar Named Desire?
Yeah, he basically got kicked out of school. He didn't know what he wanted to do with his life. His older sisters, Fran and Jocelyn, were both actresses. They went to New York before, around the time that he was supposed to be finishing up high school and figuring out what he wanted to do. And he wasn't into school, but he was into acting. That was the only thing that he had ever been really praised for. So he figured after he got kicked out of his last high school, actually a military high school, he decided he would go to New York, follow his sisters there, and check it out.
Hmm.
And Adler really discovered him and saw immediately his enormous natural talent and worked with him to develop a more professional talent.
To our listeners, this is an appreciation of Marlon Brando on what would have been his 91st birthday. Which films of his are your favorites? What does Marlon Brando mean to you? 410-662-8780 to join our conversation here on Midday on Film. Chris Reed is going to set up the clips for us. Are we going chronologically pretty much here, Chris?
We are. We'll start with A Streetcar Named Desire. But before we do, I just want to add one note. I was also surprised reading about Brando for a number of reasons. A, I didn't realize he was a Midwestern farm boy. he was called Bud by his family and friends, because he was a junior. His father's Marlon Brando as well. And I also always thought he was Italian, Brando, but he's actually more French. It's Brando is the original family name. So I learned so much prepping for the show.
Look at Flavio's frowning over there. Flavio, you thought he was Italiano too, right?
Yeah, sounds Italian.
Yeah.
Brando.
And he's got that Italian thing.
Yeah.
He was such a great mimic. He could really play anything.
Yeah.
So we're going to open with the 1951 film version of the 1947 play. The movie's Streetcar Named Desire is directed by Elia Kazan, who also directed the stage, the Broadway show. And he brought all of the cast except for Jessica Tandy, who had played Blanche on Broadway, to the screen. And she was replaced by Vivian Leigh. And, of course, this is a movie that is so famous for Brando yelling to Kim Hunter, his wife, Stella, Stella! but that's not the clip we have here. So, represents a sort of brutish mid-20th century working class man, Stanley Kowalski, sort of replacing sort of more genteel society as we emerge from World War II. And he's married to Stella, who's from this slightly more genteel society. She's played by Kim Hunter. And in this scene, she makes a mistake of kind of pushing him a little too far, kind of, in a sense, poking fun of his coarseness. And they have a very much love-hate relationship. He's abusive to her, but she can't seem to get enough of him. So we'll hear what happens when she just takes it one step too far.
Mr. Kowalski is too busy making a pig of himself to think of anything else. Face and your fingers are disgustingly greasy. Go wash up and then help me clear the table.
Now that's how I'm gonna clear the table. Don't you ever talk that way to me. Pig, Polack, disgusting, vulgar, greasy. Those kind of words have been on your tongue, and your sister's tongue is too much around here. What do you think you are, a pair of queens? I just remember what Huey Long said, that every man's a king, and I'm the king around here. And don't you forget it. My place is all cleared up now. You want me to clear yours?
Oh, I remember the good scene, good selection, Chris. Yeah, yeah. Do you want to say anything about that, Linda? Linda is sort of mouthing the words, lip syncing there.
Yes, you know that scene, huh? Oh, yes.
I know
the film very well, which was not his first film. His first film was The Men in 1950, where he played a paraplegic World War II soldier. But this film was the one that really put him on the map. And I picked the scene in part because when Tennessee Williams auditioned him and put him in the play, the original Stanley was supposed to be much older. And the play was really about, it was Blanche's play, and she was the sympathetic character. By casting Brando, he sort of balanced the play over to Stanley's side a little bit, because Brando was in some ways, unrefined, yes, but also more sympathetic than the original character had been meant to be. And in this scene, I remember I'd seen it many times alone, watching it on DVD or whatever. And then when I saw it in a theater, everybody laughed when he said, "Now I've cleared my place. You want me to clear yours?
Yeah.
And there was a sort of, sympathy for him going on that I had never really thought about before.
Right.
But it is actually true that In the stage version, especially, he took a lot of the attention away from Jessica Tandy.
I want to sprinkle in some calls from our listeners here, as we appreciate Marlon Brando. Alex in Baltimore, the first to call on this subject. Go right ahead with your comments. Alex, hi.
Hey, hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have idolized this man, Marlon Brando, since I was 15 years old. I'm 40 now. I still watch The Godfather over and over and over. I'm just curious how he got picked for that role.
Oh, as Vito Corleone by Francis Ford Coppola. Is there a story there about that?
We have a clip which we can play later. But at that point in his career, he had a series of box office flops and had developed a reputation for being difficult. So, Francis Ford Coppola, the writer director of The Godfather, who himself was having some troubles in his career because he'd had some box office flops, he sort of had to lobby hard once he decided that Brando would really be the perfect person for this role. Brando, who was certainly not nearly as old as Adon, who's supposed to be a 65-year-old man, sort of was asked to do a screen test, which is unheard of for a star, even a fallen one at that point. But Coppola tricked him into doing a screen test by having it be sort of a makeup test to see how he would look on screen as this older man. So working with Brando to kind of make himself look older, he was able to get footage of him that he could present to the studio, which would make him believable as the Don.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. So the audition was sort of while he was putting makeup on as Vito?
He did his own makeup. He took cotton balls and stuffed them in his cheeks.
He actually did that.
He took shoe polish and slicked it over his hair, slicked his hair back, put the black shoe polish on, and convinced the powers that be at Paramount that he was they couldn't believe he looked like this much, much older man. He was 47, I believe, at the time, and was so convincing. And he actually had said, "I've never played an Italian before. I don't think I can do it." But obviously, he figured out
a way. Flavio Sala, speaking of an Italian who's in the studio with us, Flavio, we're going to play a little something from The Godfather for us as we take our first break here. And we'll listen to that clip when we get back. I thought we should go with chronology. I don't know if we have to. If folks want to call in and talk about their favorite Brando movie, please do it. It's Midday on Film with Linda and Chris, 410-662-8780. Go ahead, and we'll listen also to some more Flavio Sala as we go into this break. But feel free to call. Tell us about your favorite Brando film. Flavio Sala playing guitar for us in this hour of Midday on Film as we celebrate the life of the work, the career of Marlon Brando, who would have been 91 today. He died in 2004. Since we were talking about The Godfather, of course, I guess that's what everyone thinks of when they think of Marlon Brando. I think of On the Waterfront, Terry Malloy as much. But, you know, when Alex called in and said that he idolizes Brando, it's different for men and women, I guess, how you look at it. But, you know, he's a very sexy guy. The steamy cool, I call it, of Marlon Brando, the T-shirts, the muscles, the self-confidence that comes across in all those films, the vulnerability of Terry Malloy when he's talking to his brother about what he could have been and all that. I mean, the 1960s were not good. He had some bad years there, right, Chris? And then The Godfather was a big comeback for him.
It was, although, I mean, let's be, kind of all-encompassing. It was a bad decade for him box office-wise, but he turned in some fine performances in the 60s, even if he developed an increasing reputation for being difficult to work with.
Like what?
Well, I really like him in Arthur Penn's The Chase, a flawed film, but I think he's quite good in it. I think he's fantastic in John Huston's Reflections in a Golden Eye, where he plays a deeply closeted military officer married to Elizabeth Taylor, who's carrying on an affair with Brian Keith since she's not getting what she needs from Brando.
Hmm.
Great performance by Brando.
One-Eyed Jax was in the 60s.
One-Eyed Jax was shot in the late 50s, released in 1960, the only film that he directed, where he plays Rio, a guy who's been sent to, who ended up in jail because his partner, played by Carl Malden, abandoned him. So there's definitely some, it's a great revenge story, one of the best of all time. It's a great work in the 60s, even if box office-wise it was bad.
Victor actually was calling about One-Eyed Jax. Hey, Victor, how you doing?
Yeah, hi, Dan. Well, your guest just took the words right out of my mouth about One-Eyed Jax. I was going to say the same thing. I read that he considered it his best movie, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, he directed it. You could almost call it a cult movie. When I was a teenager, there was a there was a following among my friends and brothers' friends. Some of them virtually knew the movie by heart from opening line to close and saw it 5, 10, 15 times. It's a really nuanced performance by Brando. You can't take your eyes off of him. And I do believe I've never seen a Western that tops it.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Victor. One Eye Jack's Linda, and then we have a clip from it.
Yes, yes, we do. Yes, he directed it. This is one of the most interesting, almost collaborations of all times. The original screenplay was written by Sam Peckinpah, and Stanley Kubrick was set to direct it, which led to many chess playing sessions between Kubrick and Brando at Brando's home, but unfortunately did not lead to a Stanley Kubrick directed film. Brando took over the direction himself, and indeed, it is really a kind of early revisionist Western. It is set against a seaside in Monterey. It's very unusual, and it's also very thematically very close to Brando, because it's about a man played by Carl Malden, whose name is Dad Longworth, who betrays his son-like kid, Rio. And there's the sense of burning revenge that eats up this this relationship and consumes Brando's character very much in a way reflecting his own relationship with his own father, which was fraught.
Chris?
Yeah, it's a film. It was actually one of my father's favorite films, so it's a film I remember very much from my childhood, watching many, many times. Exactly what Linda said in terms of its history. It's a flawed film. I mean, it's the only film he directed, so one can't expect every aspect of the film to be brilliant. But the story is quite compelling, as is his performance, as is Carl Malden's. And we have a clip, and this is a scene where Dad Longworth and Rio are meeting again after the many years that Rio has spent in prison because of Dad's betrayal. Now, Dad has become sheriff. He's married a woman who has a daughter. He's adopted the daughter. And now they're all having dinner together, and Rio has lied to Dad about having been in prison. He's sort of not quite sure what form his revenge is going to take if he indeed exacts it. And Dad has lied to Rio about what happened, sort of how he ended up betraying him. So here they are having dinner with Dad's new wife, played by the great Kati Jurado, who you may remember from High Noon as the sheriff's former mistress. So we've got Carl Malden, Kati Jurado, and Marlon Brando sitting around the dinner table.
We offer up our humble thanks and ask that you bless this food to our use and us to thy service. And make us ever mindful of the needs of others. In Jesus' name, amen.
I never knew you to pray over the grub before, Dad.
Yeah.
Have you known each other for a long time?
Oh, yeah. Dad and I go way back. I wasn't anything more than a kid when Dad picked me up.
I had never heard him talking about you before.
Huh? He was kind of hairy in them days.
When he was a bandit, no?
Oh, that's all right, kid. Everybody around here knows I used to be on the other side of the law. Yeah, we were a couple of cockleburrs, we were, huh? Had a lot of fun, didn't we?
Always full of laugh, Dad. You know, it's a wonder we didn't get our fool head shot off. That'd have wound up in the pen or something.
Why did you pick that scene?
Well, it sort of really sets up the tension that's going to erupt into violence later in the film, and it's all about what's not being said, right? So the kid, Rio, has lied to Dad that he didn't go to prison. And so when that last when he says that last line, there's heavy irony as he looks directly at Carl Malden and says that.
You saw Missouri Breaks recently, too.
I just watched it last night for the first time.
What would you say about that?
Oh, what an interesting, odd movie. And what a fascinating performance by Brando. That's Arthur Penn, 1975. Penn had directed him before in The Chase. It's a fascinating film. I think people have very mixed reactions to it. That's a great Western for the 70s.
You know, the reason I ask about it is because it's another Western, right? Yeah. And now we have Julius Caesar on the list as well. We have Guys and Dolls on the list as well, where he sings. So I guess we got to listen to some of these clips and talk about them. And I always wanted to ask both of you this, because when we talked about doing the Brando show a while back, I thought of Julius Caesar. I said, I got to ask Chris and Linda this. What did we think of his performance in Julius Caesar? When I've seen it, part of me wants to laugh. I'm not convinced. Other part of me thinks maybe this is really great. I don't know. I can't make up my mind about Brando and Julius Caesar.
Well, it's interesting you say that. He was nominated for an Academy Award.
Okay, well,
which means it was good, of course.
Right. Yeah. 1953. You know, so
it's very interesting because he had been known as Stanley Kowalski, and this really upset him all his life, that people associated him, a fairly sensitive, you know, self-educated but very well-read person, in many ways gentle, the opposite of Kowalski. And when, indeed, it was announced that he would play this role, no one could get over it. They thought it was ridiculous. And then it came out, and people said, you know what? This guy has acting chops. And John Gielgud, who plays Caesar, actually invited him to be a part of his company in England, to come to England to act on the stage with him because he was so blown away by his performance.
Chris, what do you say about it?
Well, I think we should just listen to him do the speech. Right. This is Mark Anthony's friends, Romans, countrymen speech at Caesar's funeral. It's really remarkable. And Gielgud sort of recorded the speech for him so he could sort of work on his cadence. But you'll hear he's really made the performance his own.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often turned with their bones. So let it be with Caesar. The noble Brutus hath told you Caesar was ambitious. If it was so, it was a grievous fault. And grievously hath Caesar answered it. Here on the leave of Brutus and the rest, for Brutus is an honorable man. So are they all honorable men. Come I to speak in Caesar's funeral. He was my friend, faithful and just to me. But Brutus says he was ambitious. And Brutus is an honorable man.
Can I ask about method acting and Shakespeare? Is that what we're hearing there? No. Or are those things incompatible?
I can offer my take.
Maybe that's where my confusion is.
Well, I don't think any form of play is incompatible with method acting, because it's about, again, it's about simply internalizing, you know, the essence of that character, and whether you go through sense memory techniques or whether you find another way to kind of really become that character, it doesn't matter what kind of story it is. And I think what's really remarkable about his performance as Mark Anthony is, first of all, not only was he known as the brutish Stanley Kowalski, but also he'd been known up until then as sort of mumbling on screen, both this and
Viva Zapata
and Streetcar. He's sort of mumbling his lines a little bit, but here he's speaking with great clarity. But it's a performance that's both really strong and really restrained. And so he's really entered into the nature of who and what Mark Anthony was. And I think it's a remarkable performance. It's his first of two collaborations with Joseph Mankiewicz, because he also did Guys and Dolls.
Do you want to go to Guys and Dolls now? We'll come back to On the Waterfront, a little stepping out of the chronology here a little bit. Because Guys and Dolls is another one where I say, wait a minute, this is Marlon Brando. He's in a musical. He's singing. Linda, help me understand. How did this happen?
Well, he was offered the role, and he was hesitant about taking it because he can't sing. At the time, he couldn't sing. He had to have his performance as a singer sort of, as he said it, sewn together in the editing room, sewn together so tightly that when he sang it, lip-synced it on camera, he practically asphyxiated himself. But it was a challenge for him, and I think he took a bet from Mankiewicz about doing this role, because he would dance and sing. He could actually dance quite well. He had he had actually studied dance in New York. But, he's really kind of great at it. And Frank Sinatra plays Nathan Detroit in this film, and he couldn't stand Brando. He did not get along with him because he hated the method, and because they gave Brando his song, Luck Be a Lady Tonight. And, of course, that was kind of that was a kick in the pants to Sinatra.
What clip do you have, Chris?
Well, this is the Luck Be a Lady clip. Okay. But also, I think Sinatra had been cast in On the Waterfront.
Yes.
And then when Kazan decided he really wanted Brando, Sinatra lost that part, which definitely fueled this hatred.
Time out. No, I didn't know this story.
Yeah.
Sinatra had been cast as Terry Malloy?
Yeah. Well, he was from New Jersey. He was perfect for it, right?
I mean, it would have been.
No. I'm typecasting. Well, it
would
have been.
It would not
have
been.
Sorry, what I said about the Midwest.
Sure, it would not have been a bad movie. It's just it's hard to imagine since Brando is so perfect as Terry Malloy. But so there was this enmity on Sinatra's part. But nevertheless, I think it's a really remarkable performance in Guys and Dolls as well. Mm-hmm. He's Sky Masterson. He ends up wooing Gene Simmons, and in this scene, he's. If you know the Frank Lesser musical, right? It's great Frank Lesser music here. He's basically betting on rolls of dice that all these gamblers will that evening go to the mission that Gene Simmons runs. So he's betting his money on them filling up her mission house. And here we have Brando singing Luck Be a Lady.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Lucky if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight. Luck let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with, luck be a lady with me. A lady doesn't leave her escort, it isn't fair, it isn't nice. A lady doesn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. So let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby.
It's Midday on Film. We're appreciating the life, the career of Marlon Brando. We'll be right back.
Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady tonight.
And this is Midday, Midday on Film. Dan Roderick's here. Playing guitar for us in Studio A is Flavio Sala, FlavioSala.com is his website. You get more information about his upcoming performances, two in Baltimore that I mentioned, Germano's on April 10th, an online concert on April 19th, May 3rd at Evangelical Lutheran Church in Frederick, Maryland. Flavio, what are you playing? What's that you're playing?
Preludio number 1 by Villa Lobos.
Back to our conversation about Marlon Brando now, and I didn't want to jump over on the waterfront. I don't want to leave that behind. So, Chris picked out a clip from this. We should talk about this performance a little bit here.
Yeah, I picked it out. I have to give credit where credit is due with Linda's assistance. This was a scene that was very interesting to Linda, so she will also have a lot to say about it. So this is returning to work with Kazan after two previous films, A Streetcar Named Desire and Viva Zapata. He had some mixed feelings about working with Kazan because Kazan had just recently informed on his colleagues, right, naming names in front of House Committee on Un-American Activities, which Brando thought was unforgivable. But he still also thought that Kazan was the greatest director he'd ever worked with and brought out great performances from him. So it's a film set on the New Jersey docks in the world of unions and mobsters. He plays Terry Malloy, a former boxer who, as it turns out later in the film, was more or less betrayed by his brother, being prevented from having the career he could have had. And he's been used by the mob to help, in the beginning of the film, kill an informant. And he slowly realizes in the course of the film how he's been used. And here he is in a scene with Eva Marie Saint, the sister of the young man who was killed at the start of the film. And through his relationship with her and with a priest, played by Carl Malden, he begins to have this sort of moral awakening.
You know, I've seen you a lot of times before. Remember parochial school out of Paluski Street? 7-8 years ago, your hair...
Braids.
Looked like a hunk of rope. You had wires on your teeth and glasses, everything. You was really a mess.
I can get home all right now, thanks.
Hey, there's no get sore, just kidding you a little bit. I just mean to tell you that you grew up very nice.
Thanks.
You don't remember me, do you?
remember you the first moment I saw you.
Quite a nose, huh? Well, some people just got faces that stick in your mind.
Yeah, it's too bad we can't see it, because at least half of it is gesture and expression. And this is the beginnings of their relationship, their romance, very improbable, because he has, after all, been responsible for her brother's death. And I think it's the high watermark of his career in some ways, at least the first part of it. It is the epitome of the greatness of method acting. It's so seemingly natural. And the way we see this character develop, change, come to accept responsibility and get a sense of himself in the world is just one of the most, I think, remarkable performances on screen.
410-662-8780 is the phone number if you'd like to join us for this conversation about Marlon Brando. Which films of his are your favorites? What does Marlon Brando mean to you? Another caller on this, Anne in Baltimore, before we move on to the next clip. Hi, Anne.
Hi. It's actually Aaron, but that's okay. So years ago, I guess it was 1977, I met Marlon Brando when he came through to join up with a march that was called the Trail of the Longest Walk, and it was in memory of the Trail of Tears. It started out in Alcatraz and came all the way to D.C. And Dennis Banks, who with Russell Means founded the American Indian Movement, was staying at a house I was taking care of. I was only 17, and I didn't appreciate the caliber of people that I met in this situation. And Marlon Brando was very much in support of the indigenous folks in this country and was very politically active. And he and Muhammad Ali and Steve Gaskin, who founded the farm in Tennessee, this whole group of people, I actually got to spend the whole day with them and other hours as well. And they were just the most gracious, aware. I didn't feel like the dopey 17-year-old that I was amongst this group of luminaries. And one other thing I wanted to mention, besides his graciousness and his extreme political awareness, was the film Burn, which was not shown in this country for years. I wouldn't say it was his greatest film, but the topic was extremely controversial, and it was a look at the history of the sugarcane industry and the rum industry in the Caribbean, and it takes place in the 18th century, and it's worth mentioning that it basically got blacklisted, and I will take your responses off the air.
All right, before you go, Aaron, where were you when you had this encounter when you were 17? Was that here in Maryland?
Well, what it was that the march was coming through Baltimore, and they needed places to stay, the people in charge, Dennis Banks and the other and Native American folks involved. And I happened to be taking care of a house for the summer for a former school teacher of mine. I just graduated from high school, and I was very politically active at the time, but not as aware of what I was really doing and involved in. And anyway, the day that the march was making its final trip to D.C., because this was to say that basically the Trail of Tears, which took...
You mean, I just had a brief question there. That was here. This happened in Maryland.
They came through Maryland, right? Okay. And Muhammad Ali and all these other people came at the final leg of the march, and because these folks were staying at my house, all of these people came through, and I got to spend the entire day with them on the final day of the march, and it was basically a march to let known that all the treaties between the indigenous people, Native Americans, and the U.S. government had been completely abrogated, and that was in 1977, and not much has changed since. But the thing about Brando that struck me, and all of these people, including Muhammad Ali, and they were so gracious, sincere, and genuine.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm sorry. In the interest of time, we're going to move on here. Does anyone have a comment about Burn, the film Burn?
Yes.
Are you familiar with it, Linda?
Oh, yes. Yes, very familiar with it. And it's a really fine film by Ponte Corvo, who directed The Battle of Algiers and was actually one of Brando's favorite directors, and this was among his favorite performances. And it is a very politically aware film. as was Brando himself. He was very involved with AIM. He was very involved in the civil rights movement. He was in the 63 March on Washington. He was a friend of Dr. King's. This became his overriding passion. Some people would say to the detriment of his career. He was always becoming involved in causes, including the Black Panthers. So this was a very major part of his life, and Byrne was a pet project that he especially wanted to do.
That's why at the Academy Awards in 73, he didn't accept the award.
Right. Saatchi and Littlefeather accepted it.
Thank you very much. Can we go to the Godfather clip then?
Sure, that's a great segue, since he did not accept his second Oscar, which was for The Godfather. And this marks a real transition for Brando, too. Not only is it sort of a return to box office success and widely critically acclaimed performance, but it's also really the transition from his younger roles into playing a father. And as we mentioned briefly earlier, he had a very troubled relationship with his father. And here he plays the Don, a father figure to many. And in the scene that we chose, here he is sort of passing the torch to Michael, played by Al Pacino, who is of this new generation of method actors in the 70s. So he's also passing the torch in that sense. And it's a wonderful scene late in the film. It needs no further introduction. It's Brando and Pacino.
I knew that Santana was going to have to go through all this. And Fredo, and I never wanted this for you. I worked my whole life. I don't apologize to take care of my family. And I refused to be a fool. Dancing on the string held by all those big shots. I don't apologize, that's my life, but I thought that... But when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the strings. Senator Corleone. Governor Corleone, something.
I'm not a peasant of Anta.
Well... This wasn't enough time, Michael. Wasn't enough time.
Wasn't enough time?
Wasn't enough time.
Linda, what do you want to say about Brando and The Godfather?
What is there
tour
left
de force.
To say?
Tour de force.
Yes, a tour de force. Yeah. And people who had loved him since the beginning of his career thought, this is the second act, and this is the, from now on, maybe he can fulfill his promise. There was always, especially after the dreadful 60s, the sense that he had wasted his talent, and this was a redemption, along with Last Tango in Paris. And then, of course, he decided, nah, I don't think I want to do this, really. I'm not. It's too much for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it did not turn out to be the second act.
He showed up in a film in 1990 called The Freshman, which was pretty good.
That's right, where he's basically spoofing his performance from The Godfather.
Yeah.
Just, Linda says that he made this decision not to really continue with these kinds of performances. It really is a sense of wasted potential. Sort of starting in the mid-70s onward, Brando became known for working, getting as much money as he could for as little time as possible on a movie set.
Like Superman.
Like Superman, which he's actually quite good in. Yeah. It doesn't mean that his performances weren't always good, but this kind of commitment to acting that he had exhibited in the 50s and even in the 60s sort of became replaced with other needs. And he always had a complicated relationship to stardom anyway, so... Mm-hmm.
Francis Ford Coppola got him into Apocalypse Now, and I like Crazy Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. I like that movie. Some people think it's a big mess, and that his performance is, I don't know. I've heard a lot of criticism, even ridicule of it over the years, but I like it.
I would consider it what I call an amazing mess or a magnificent mess, in the sense that I do think that the film is problematic, but it's fascinating to watch, as is his performance. He showed up, as he would so many times at this point in his career, grossly overweight, surprising the director. So they had to work on interesting lighting schemes, because Kurtz is supposed to be a really athletic man in his mid-40s. But it really is a magnetic performance nonetheless.
Yeah. you have a clip.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So this is a clip from late in the movie when Martin Sheen finally shows up. He's been traveling to meet Kurtz to assassinate him throughout the film. And here Kurtz is going to explain in some sense sort of how he became this monster in the jungle.
It's impossible through words to describe what is necessary to those who do not know what horror means. Horror. Horror has a face. And you must make a friend of horror. Horror and moral terror are your friends. If they are not, then they are enemies to be feared. They are truly enemies.
Wow. Colonel Kurtz, I got to see that again. I haven't seen that in a while. But by the way, we didn't mention Mutiny on the Bounty. Mm-hmm. You like that film too, Linda?
Yes, I think it kind of gets a raw deal. It was an over-budget production for which Brando got most of the blame. He was they said he was difficult on set and that he was the source of the overruns. Brando always claimed that this was MGM's fault and that he had been that it was really not his fault. And it was the big break in his career in the sense that after that, he really, really despised Hollywood and had nothing but contempt for filmmaking and unfortunately for his own talent as well. He was beyond self-deprecating about his abilities to the point almost of it was infuriating because he would never say at least that he took his talent seriously, even though it was clear that he did. From
he didn't like the celebrity, he didn't like being a star.
I think it was very damaging to him.
Linda, one film to recommend, a Brando film to recommend this weekend if someone wants to get a dose of Brando, not The Godfather.
Right. Oh, I would second Chris's recommendation of Reflections in a Golden Eye, which is a very little known performance. John Huston directed, and it's a remarkable performance.
Linda DeLibero is Director of Film and Media Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, Chair and Professor of the Department of Film and Video at Stevenson University. They joined us once a month for Midday on Film. I want to thank you very much for being here for this appreciation of Marlon Brando on what would have been his 91st birthday. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan.
Flavio, play us out, would you please? It's been a pleasure to have you on our show today, Flavio. Flavio Sala. He'll be at Germano's on April 10th. He's going to play some music as we finish out this hour of Midday on Film and this week of Midday. And we'll be back again on Monday. So please enjoy Flavio on the guitar, and we'll have a great weekend. Happy Passover. Happy Easter.
Producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Marjorie Goodman, Aaron Morenzi, and Mary Troutman. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.